Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story, or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the passage I'm reading is from Shirlene Obuobi's debut novel, On Rotation. "Are you sure you can't stay any longer?" my father asked. He leaned against my doorframe with his arms folded, watching me stuff my pajamas into my duffel bag. His expression had all the mournfulness of the family pet watching his favorite visiting college kid pack at the end of a break. I would have felt worse about my quick escape if he hadn't spent all of dinner last night interrogating me about my grades. "I have a meeting at 1 with Dr. Wallace," I reminded him. It wasn't a complete lie. I did have a meeting at 1 p.m. with Dr. Wallace in 2 weeks, but I also had almost 25 years of immigrant parent experience, and I knew that the best way to avoid a guilt trip when trying to make an early exit was to come up with a school-related excuse. "Well, next time you should come home earlier," he said petulantly. "You have a car and you live close. You need to commit more time to family." "Miss you too, Daddy," I thought. "I'll visit soon," I said, skirting past him. Mama was already at work, a small blessing, I promise. "Okay," he said, following me out the front door. He pulled me into a hug that would have been comforting if my skin hadn't been crawling with anxiety. "Drive safe. Tell Nia I said hi." Last night had only temporarily delayed my despondence. After 24 hours of high-intensity exposure to practically all the potential triggers for my impending breakdown, I was in need of two things. One, an exit plan, which I had achieved, and two, a distraction. I texted Nia, but she had planned for my absence by finally scheduling the bread-making class I'd given her for Christmas and wouldn't be home until late. Michelle, who had journeyed with me from our Midwestern college to our Midwestern medical school, was still on her step study block and wouldn't be free to hang for another week. A bummer. I couldn't very well go sit in my apartment alone with my thoughts. I would have to entertain myself. Thankfully, it was summer in Chicago. Every Friday to Sunday, there was bound to be a niche street festival or four to explore, a free concert, a park performance of King Lear. I scrolled through the city calendar of events, selected an art fair in Pilsen that was only 20 minutes from my apartment, and went on my merry way. Evidently, the entire city had the same idea. "Y'all don't have to go to work," I muttered, grinding my teeth as I drove further and farther away from the festival, looking for a free parking spot. "This is fine," I reminded myself, tamping down on my frustration before it could bubble over and turn into misery. "You have nothing but time to burn. Besides, it'll be nice to explore the neighborhood." Eventually, I found parking about a mile and a half away from the festival entrance. Outside, the bright afternoon sun flared in full force. Somehow, I had forgotten that a world existed outside my sphere, one that consisted of city noise and summer color. I thought back to my last few months, which I'd spent holed up in various libraries studying for STEP or hiding away in suburbia at my parents' house, and realized that I hadn't been properly out in a long time. My world had narrowed to me, Nia, and the occasional interloper, and the abrupt expansion to so much more stretched my senses thin. I popped my headphones in and selected an upbeat song, the soundtrack for my reintroduction to my bright new world. Pilsen had a grungy charm, I decided. I'd wandered its streets before, but almost always at night, almost always after drowning my post-exam sorrows with Michelle at some bar. A shame. A neighborhood like this deserved to be appreciated sober and in the light of day. Practically every building featured a colorful, heavily detailed mural and the juxtaposition of cultures. Mexican, Chinese, gentrifying yuppie meant that every block hid a pleasant surprise. About a mile into my walk, a gated clearing came into view, an interruption of brick and awnings with lush green and pink and yellow. It was small, barely half a block wide, but glorious. A flaking, hand-painted sign at the entrance designated the area as Lydia's Floral Arrangements Urban Garden, established 2013. And another read, public access encouraged. Despite the inviting message on the sign, Lydia's garden was unoccupied. The gate creaked noisily as I entered. Inside, the garden was even more breathtaking than I expected. Butterflies fluttered through the air, and squat, fuzzy bumblebees buzzed over the petals of bright orange daylilies. I knelt in front of a rose bush so perfect that my mother might have tried to uproot it. My fingers hovered over the unblemished white blossoms, just barely brushing against the velvet-soft petals. Frederick used to bring me flowers. On our first date, I told him that I hated them as gifts. There's so much work to prep. You can't really do anything with them, and they die, like, instantly, I told him. And after that, every time I saw him, he had some for me. A fat blue hydrangea blossom, a bushel of baby's breath, a half a dozen red roses. At first, I thought it was our little joke. I would hunt around my apartment for the most ridiculous container for them. Empty coffee canisters, Diet Coke bottles, and once a whole saucepan, and put them in a place of honor in the living room for him to find. At first, Frederick had played along, egging me on. But after a few weeks, the flowers stopped coming. And then one day, when we were out to eat, he told me that I was ungrateful. I bet every woman in this room would love to get flowers from their man, he'd insisted. And I realized that all along, he hadn't been getting those flowers for me. He'd been getting them for himself, to prove that he was the kind of guy who got girls flowers. And deep down, I'd known that. Suddenly, I felt fragile, like a cheap glass teetering at the edge of a counter, only a nudge away from shattering. I knew I was headed into a vicious cycle, and fast. Unmitigated sadness I had no right to feel, followed by self-loathing, because of course I still felt it. I sat down on the sun-warmed stone of the garden path, tucking my knees to my chest and watching the dark splotches of my tears splash and spread on my jeans. What was wrong with me? It was like Tabs had said, I didn't love Frederick, and he hardly liked me. I was too brash for him, too unpolished. He wanted a poised political wife, and I had been willing, for a while, to flatten myself to fit that mold. And for what? 8-year-old Angie had dreamed of white coats, not white weddings. And instead of focusing on studying for the last major hurdle in the way of that dream, I had let myself be distracted, anguishing over how to fix a relationship with a man I didn't even want. Excuse me, a voice said. I yelped in shock, my hands flying instinctively to cover my face. The cords of my earbuds caught on my arms, sending my earbuds flying and cutting my music off halfway through in fantasia. Okay, so the guy kneeling in front of me was cute. Real cute. I hadn't gotten a particularly good look, as I was presently trying my best to disappear. But it had been enough for my body to know that it was attracted to his. That alone made me want to push past him and go flying out the garden gate. Cute boy laughed good-naturedly as I swiped at my tears, trying in vain to gather the scattered fragments of my dignity. Kishibashi, he said, you've got good taste. It took me a moment to realize that he was talking about my music. My volume had been turned all the way up. No wonder I hadn't heard him approach. I sniffed, accepting my earbuds back as he handed them to me. Thanks, I said numbly, finally letting myself look at him. Good God, he was hot. Maybe not to Nia, who would probably say he was too lean, but he was exactly my type. Tallish, with thick black eyebrows and an unabashedly sunny smile. He was some kind of brown, maybe South Asian, probably Latin, and dressed simply in black joggers and a burgundy hoodie that was, embarrassingly, almost the exact same color as my shirt. He had his longish hair pushed back and secured with a thin headband. His inevitable girlfriend was probably desperate to cut it. Are you okay? He asked, and I winced. I don't mean to bother you, but... His smile became sympathetic. You looked like you needed bothering. I'm fine, I said, stretching to my feet. Now that the initial shock had worn off, I was wary. That a boy had approached me in the wild was not particularly unusual. I was still my mother's daughter, after all. Men finding excuses to stop me in the street had ceased being a compliment and become more of a nuisance not long after I hit puberty, and I had since perfected the art of wheedling myself out of unwanted conversations. Every now and then, though, I wouldn't want to escape. I would find the guy charming, and we would banter and flirt, exchange numbers and talk for a good length of time before he abruptly ghosted, or worse, I discovered that he wasn't actually on the market. This was not one of those times. Cute boy was attractive, but he had atrocious timing. "It's okay if you aren't fine," he was saying. He stood up too, shoving his hands deep into his pockets. "I won't judge." I narrowed my eyes. "So is this what you do?" I asked. "Hide out in the bushes like some kind of troll, and then pop out to offer comfort to all the crying girls who come into this garden?" He laughed. "Who's hiding?" he said. He pointed at a bench a few feet away, only somewhat obscured by a row of delphiniums. Blood rushed to my ears. How had I missed him there? I was just sitting there, minding my business. You're the one who came barging into a public garden to have a cry. "You've been here this whole time?" I said, my stomach sinking. "Well, yeah," he said. "I was going to leave you alone, but you sounded pretty miserable. Though, I will admit, the whole thing was pretty cinematic, what with this backdrop." Just as I was about to sink into the earth, he added, "Nothing to be ashamed of. I've had a couple good cries here myself." That gave me pause, not just because he was making light of my breakdown, but because he'd offered up his own. I couldn't remember the last time a man had told me that he cried without shame. "You have?" I said. "Oh, yeah. To answer your question, though, I usually come here to draw." He ducked his head, suddenly shy. "And, I was actually hoping to ask you a favor." "Here it goes," I thought. "I was wondering if I could draw you." My heart stammered in my chest. It was a strange request, but flattering all the same, and I could tell that he was serious. I could see now that he'd left a small book and a pencil pouch on the bench. "Oh," I said. Cute boy seemed to have used up all his bravado on his initial approach, because now he could barely meet my eyes. "Sorry," he said. "I know it's kind of a weird thing to ask." "No," I said quickly. When his smile faltered, I added, "I mean, no, it's not weird." Well, it is, but I don't mind. You can draw me." He smiled so widely you would have thought I'd offered to pay his rent. "Oh, okay, great," he said, noticeably more animated. "My name's Ricky, by the way, and you are?" "Angela," I said, "Angie." "It's nice to meet you," he said. Then, all business, headed back to the bench. At Ricky's discretion, I sat cross-legged in a patch of sunlight on the ground across from him. The foliage around me left dappled shadows across my legs, but spared my face. He instructed me to put my hands on my knees, then changed his mind and had me fold them in my lap. When he was satisfied, he pulled his sketchbook onto his lap and began to draw. The early summer breeze shifted through the trees, still carrying with it the sting of spring chill. Without my music, I could hear the loud stillness of the city, cars zooming down the street only tens of feet away, birds chirping, Ricky's pencils scratching against paper. The places where the sun touched my skin felt warm and light, and I took in a deep, cleansing breath. I felt loose and liquid and languid. It was the most at peace I had felt in months. "You can move, you know," Ricky said after a while. I opened my eyes to find him looking at me with amusement. "Doesn't my pose matter?" I asked. He smiled, switching out his graphite pencil for a colored one. "Not anymore, not really," he said. "I just wanted to get your face right." Then he stuck his tongue out, teasing. "This isn't the Royal Academy. I don't need you to stay put for 6 hours for your portrait." "Nice of you to wait." I checked my phone for the time. 15 minutes to tell me that. I bent forward in a stretch, making a show of shaking out my kinks. "Are you almost done?" "Yep," he said. "Hang on a second." He pulled a corner of his top lip into his mouth, his eyebrows furrowed with concentration. I watched him as he switched between colored pencils automatically, using only red, yellow, and blue. After a few more minutes, he grinned up at me. "Okay, here." I sat next to Ricky on the bench, accepting the sketchbook, when he handed it to me. In the millisecond before it could exchange hands, it occurred to me that he could like to draw, but be terrible at it, and I would have to praise the stranger for highlighting my worst features. But I needn't have worried. "What, Ricky?" I said, dumbstruck. By cross-hatching the primary colors together, Ricky had managed to bring a new, shimmering dimension to the garden, merging and blurring the flowers and leaves into a mere suggestion of themselves, and the image of me. It emanated peace and contentment, and none of the turmoil I was feeling in reality. He'd made me so beautiful, and so effortlessly. My throat tightened, and I felt my eyes well with tears again. "Do you like it?" Ricky asked. "Of course. It's stunning," I stammered. The tears I tried to hold back trailed down my face, and I sighed and wiped them away before they could fall onto his small masterpiece. "Oh no," I said, exasperated. "Sorry, I can't seem to stop doing this today." "Hey, it's okay," Ricky said in a low voice. Then he added, "Do you want to talk about it?" "No offense, Ricky," I said with a snort, "but why do you care?" Ricky's expression didn't change. Instead, there was a flicker of strain behind his eyes, like a light being turned off and then back on again. Gone and back so quickly that I might have missed it if I hadn't been specifically searching it out. But then, his smile disappeared altogether, and he leaned back on the bench, rubbing his chin thoughtfully. Honestly, I don't know," he said finally. "I just knew that if I didn't talk to you, I'd regret it." "You are not an experience," Rational Angie said, but Hopeless Angie had already taken over. This close, I could see that Ricky's eyes were the color of Coca-Cola, the kind in a glass bottle, clear mahogany in the shifting afternoon light, that he smelled like freshly laundered clothes and spearmint gum. My gaze drifted to his exposed forearms, not muscular exactly, but masculine, with roping veins and long lines of sinew. I wanted to ask him what about me he thought he would miss. I felt like he would answer truthfully, and that answer would fill me. "Fine," I said, "but law of equivalent exchange, okay? I need your tales of woe too." If he was offended by my demand, he didn't show it. Instead, he let out a bark of laughter. "Oh my God," he said, looking at me with awe. "Is that a Full Metal Alchemist reference? Are you a weeb?" "See, I knew it. I knew you were kin." His smile was so damn bright that I had to avert my eyes. Thankfully, he was too busy fiddling with the zipper of his hoodie to notice. I thought at first that he was removing it because he was too warm, but instead he pulled the lapels apart to show me the symbol on the shirt he was wearing underneath it. "An earthbender, really," I said, chuckling at his enthusiasm. I would give the man credit where it was due. He was very good at cheering me up. "Would have pegged you for air, actually." Ricky looked genuinely affronted. "An airbender? Me?" he scoffed. "What would give you that idea?" "Your sunny disposition," I posited. "Your general spontaneity." "Me," Ricky said. "I'm not spontaneous at all." I snorted, gesturing in an arc around us. "Ricky, hate to break it to you, but, why am I here talking to you right now if you're not spontaneous?" "I thought we established that my talking to you is part of a great cosmic plan," Ricky said, smirking. "No, but really, I'm not. I angst over every decision I make. It took me years to build up the courage to just say, you know what? I just will do what I want to do. I almost ended up going to law school because of that." "Law," I swallowed, imagining Ricky, hair slicked back, socializing with Frederick and his seedy lawyer friends in the back of a bar that straddled the line between classy and drug front. Yeah, I don't see it either. My grandpa did, though, so I entertained it for a bit," he explained. "Really?" I asked. "Immigrant parents push their kids into medicine all the time. But as Mama had astutely observed, lawyers don't make that much money these days." "Does he work in the field?" Ricky laughed. "Nah," he said, "he's a carpenter. Like it or not, I clearly got the art thing from him. He mostly builds custom furniture these days." He pulled out his phone, beaming with pride. "Like, check this out." He skimmed through a series of photos showcasing beautifully sculpted, detailed vanities. One of them even had an interactive mirror, the likes of which I had only seen on the internet. You've been listening to The Big Snore. That was a passage from Shirlene Obuobi's novel, On Rotation. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Until next time.